At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.
Lowe's knows how to help make your home holiday ready for less. Get Select Style Selections vinyl flooring for just $1.99 per square foot and have it installed before the festivities begin. Our team can help you every step of the way. See a Lowe's Red Vest associate or visit lowes.com/holiday install to get started. Lowe's, we help, you save. Basic install only. Date restrictions apply. Subject to availability. Install by independent contractor. See associate for details. Contiguous U.S. only.
Do you want me to tee you up for that? Laura, how did we get from moving pictures to projections?
That's a great question, Belle, and I'm so glad you asked.
Drive the highway down the moon. Past the billboard where you see me. Ask the people for the king.
Welcome back to the Silver Nitrate Witches Movie Review Brew Potion Edition, where we talk about a little film or cinema factoid that we think is cool and hope that you will too. We are your Silver Nitrate Witches. I'm Isabel Lang. I'm a poet, academic editor, and tarot reader.
And I'm Laura Valenza, co-film editor at the Brooklyn Rail.
And today, in our little potion bottle, we are uncorking a story about Hollywood.
Okay, here we go. Mm-hmm. I'm not doing a witch for the mini episodes, okay?
That's fair, I assumed.
I'm going to save those for the big ones. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay.
I don't have any tarot cards for Hollywood either, so that's fine. We're just...
I know. I was going to tell you to do one for Thomas Edison, but I was like, that would be hard for you to do, though, without hearing the story. So I was actually kind of thinking at the end of being like, is there a tarot card that comes to mind we've talked about this?
We'll do it off the cuff. It's a mini-sode. Anything goes.
Yeah. Okay. So when we think of Hollywood, Belle, mm-hmm. we think of red carpets, palm trees, and the great state of New Jersey.
Yes, ma'am.
So for this mini-episode, our potion episode, our topic potion is bottle. How... Our potion bottle. Ooh. Our potion vial.
Ooh! A vial, ooh. Yes.
It's a good word. So our topic today is how Hollywood was almost Fort Lee, New Jersey. So you're welcome, California.
Fort Lee. That's your people. That's the heartland or something. There's a line in America's Sweethearts where they talk about Fort Lee, New Jersey. Sorry. Kathy Moriarty says it. It's great.
Hi, Editing Belle here. It is not America's Sweethearts where Kathy Moriarty says this line. It is in the movie Soap Dish, which contains a character who is known as America's Sweetheart. Not that that's important, but anyway, continue, Laura and Belle.
Well, that's perfect, because I was kind of like, I feel like I gotta give people some context if they don't know what Fort Lee is, and that's a lot better than the context I could think of, which is, it's where the bridge was, where somebody died in an ambulance because of the traffic jam, because Chris Christie did something stupid a few years ago. That was like the last time I made national news.
That is better context. That's more accurate context than Kathy Moriarty, because I even know that news story. But
okay,
the Kathy Moriarty one is just maybe a little fun.
I know. When I was thinking about that, it's like, wow, remember when Chris Christie was our worst nightmare?
Oh my God.
So there's a couple misconceptions in the whole premise of our fun little factoid about how New Jersey was almost Hollywood. So first of all, it's actually not just Fort Lee, but a number
of
towns.
Big, yeah. Huh?
Yeah. I mean, Fort Lee it's not small population wise, but small square footage. but a number of towns on the New Jersey side of the Hudson River, just opposite of New York City, were part of this early Hollywood-esque life. And as much as I'd like to make the argument that these New York bedroom communities of northern New Jersey were the OG Hollywood, that's not actually completely accurate either. One historian of this time actually says that Hollywood was developing as a film scene kind of concurrently with the New Jersey communities. It's a little bit more nuanced.
It would have made a lot of sense to have one on either coast, though.
Yeah, well, and actually in the early days, there was also, like, film scenes building up in Chicago, too, and other, mm-hmm. and Philadelphia. So mm-hmm. there was actually several major cities where you kind of start seeing this early film scene. However, that does not mean that New Jersey did not play an important role on the soundstage of early Hollywood history. So, and, you know, in all seriousness, there was actually a legit film scene in North Jersey. So let's go through, like, the who's who in Fort Lee and the surrounding area. Have you ever heard of Theda Bara?
Yes, I... I don't actually know.
Was she recently referenced in a movie really like Belle?
I don't actually know who she is, but I do know she is like a classic Hollywood actress just because that's what the gator is named in X and Pearl.
Yes.
And then in the beginning of Maxine, she stomps out a cigarette on Theda Bara's star on the Hollywood Walk of Fame. And that is my only point of reference for Theda Bara. I have no idea who she is outside of the X trilogy.
Well, she was a very early silent film star, and so in that time, people tended to kind of play certain types,
yes.
and so she is, like, the OG vamp character.
That makes
sense.
The
very, like, you know, mm-hmm. sexy, sultry, mm-hmm. bad girl type. And so Theda Bara was making movies over in Fort Lee.
Oh, okay.
We also have Fatty Arbuckle, who is a comedic actor.
Yeah.
He started out in Fort Lee. This is an interesting one. The Marx Brothers' very first movie, which was called Humor Risk, was shot in Fort Lee. So I've got, there's a great resource that really helped with the making of this episode. So shout out to the Barrymore Film Center, which
of course
is in Fort Lee. But they said on their website that the film had one screening in the Bronx and then it's been lost. And allegedly Groucho Marx in the 70s said he would pay thousands to get the film back.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I did find a summary of what they think this movie is about, and it sounds really stupid and ridiculous. All right, this is kind of more a claim to infamy than a claim to fame, but D.W. Griffith got his start here, and so he became famous as the director of Birth of a Nation, a movie that is very controversially often taught in kind of like film history 101, because he pioneered a lot of actually very modern techniques of film editing and how to, and cinematography and stuff. But for those who don't know, Birth of a Nation is like about the Civil War and is like super racist and terrible. Yeah, so because Griffith was a director who came out to Fort Lee, he also brought with him other early silent era film stars, Lillian and Dorothy Gish. Lillian Gish would later star in Birth of a Nation. I actually haven't seen Birth of a Nation, but I think that Lillian Gish's role, yeah, she was in a lot of like the big movies from this early era, but I think her role in Birth of a Nation is kind of the very like cliche, using like the white woman as the helpless symbol of good conservative white America under threat from non-white people. Yeah.
Where are the white really... people? What's that movie that you always joke about?
Bonfire of the Vanities.
Yes.
Yeah. And Griffith also brought Mary Pickford over. So they directed in 1909. They did the movie The Lonely Villa. And so according to the Barrymore Film Center, this movie was important because of this technique that Griffith used called cross-cutting, or the cut back, and that helped build tension in the narrative. In 1912, Griffith does a movie called The New York Cat.
Cat? Like, cat?
I don't know. I feel like I should double check the name of that one, but that's what I have written down.
Okay.
And so that was filmed in Fort Lee.
I believe you. I just didn't know if I heard you properly. That's why I wanted to confirm.
In a town called Coitz Fortville. I don't know if I'm pronouncing that correctly, but also a town in that Fort Lee
area. It's your state, not mine. I don't know what to tell you.
It's spelled C-O-Y-T-E-S-V-I-L-L-E. So I'm going with Coitsville.
I got it. C-O-Y-T-E-S-V-I-L-L-E. Coitusville?
Coitusville,
maybe? That sounds dirty. Coitsville doesn't sound much better, if I'm being honest. But there's a boutique Louisiana, so I don't really have more room to talk.
There's also a Hohokus, New Jersey.
There's a Middlesex in New Jersey.
There is a Middlesex in New Jersey. Mm-hmm. There's other sexes, too. Sussex.
That one doesn't hit as hard on the sex, I feel like. You know what I mean?
I spent part of my childhood in a town called Piscataway in Middlesex County.
I forgot about Piscataway. That just has, I mean, I didn't even think of the piss in there. It's just as fun to say Piscataway.
Yeah, Piscataway of Middlesex County.
I remember the first time I read a book where part of it took place in Poughkeepsie.
Oh, yeah.
I had no idea how to pronounce it because it's one of those things I'd only ever seen written down and I never heard aloud. Mm-hmm. And so I thought it was Poughkeepsie. And that's how I was reading it every time. And then the first time I heard it out loud, it was like...
That's like... Okay, so... For anybody who didn't know, I'm from New Jersey, so this is our Jersey Pride episode, and I'm so sorry that's coming up, and we're in the middle of our Griffin section.
You need your little Jersey girl hat.
Oh, yeah, I have a Jersey girl hat. I should have worn that. Mm-hmm. But I grew up my whole life hearing about the Schuylkill Expressway on the radio, because at rush hour, you know, they do the traffic reports, and the Schuylkill Expressway is the big highway connecting Philadelphia to people who are commuting between like New Jersey and Philly. I also grew up seeing signs for the river around Philadelphia that I thought were pronounced Schuylkill because it was S-C-H-U-Y-L-K-I-L-L.
Yeah.
And it was not until adulthood that I realized Schuylkill Expressway and the Schuylkill River are the same word.
I would not have put those together either. That's wild.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, I would not have, yeah.
Yeah.
Would have also been Coitsville. Coitsville.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So this movie. All right. So cool detail about this movie. It was written by a woman, Anita Luce.
Wait.
Who's.
Which movie?
The Griffith movie. The New York Hat.
The New York Hat. Anita Luce?
Yeah.
I'll let
Who
you.
Who is also an interesting person in her own right, and we could do an entire
yes,
episode.
Yes. I
so
love
this
Anita
movie
Luce.
Is made
she also
in
wrote
1912.
Gentlemen Prefer Blondes.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah, no, I definitely... And then I think she did one that was, but they marry brunettes or something.
Shut the fuck up. Oh my god, I love that. Have you ever read the actual text, Gentlemen Prefer Blondes?
No, I have not.
It's very fun. It was serialized first, and then it was compiled into a novel later, so it's like kind of funny and silly and jumpy. You, I think you would dig it. You would like it a lot. The movie is also excellent. But, sorry, Anita Luce wrote the Griffith movie.
I think she was sort of part of that flapper
moment,
mm-hmm, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, and so the movie starred Mary Pickford, Lionel Barrymore, Dorothy Gish, and Lillian Gish. So, I mentioned Barrymore. Maurice Barrymore, who is... the generation before Lionel Barrymore. It turns out the Barrymore dynasty goes back a lot farther than I realized. Mm-hmm. So he was a... Oh god, Coitsville is back. He was a Coitsville, New Jersey resident.
Coitsville.
And he was a Broadway actor. Ah. So the Barrymores have been acting since before there were movies to act in.
That's so funny.
And for those who don't know, we're talking about Drew Barrymore's family.
Yeah.
So like... You're welcome. The great state of New Jersey gave you the classic Ever After. I know. Pretty cool. Yeah. So that's a fun little fact. So he was not in movies in North Jersey, but he was hanging out in the scene and then going over to New York and doing Broadway theater. And, all right, I have some a fun fact that will make up for Griffith. Mm-hmm. There is this awesome filmmaker who I learned about like a year or so ago when Film Forum did like a whole screening series of his movies. A lot of them sadly have been lost, mm-hmm. but his name was Oscar Michaud, and he also made a movie called Within Our Gates. It was filmed in Fort Lee, and it was supposed to be the opposite of Griffith's Birth of a Nation. So Michaud makes this movie Within Our Gates in 1919. Birth of a Nation comes out in 1915, which, by the way, I checked, and Birth of a Nation was not filmed in New Jersey.
Good.
Doesn't really make it better. But anyway, the cool thing was that Oscar Michaud was an early African-American filmmaker, and so he makes this movie Within Our Gates to push back against the horrible racist politics of Birth of a Nation and reveal, like, the Black perspective of American history. And he continues to be a prolific filmmaker and stays, even when movies move out to Hollywood, he stays in New Jersey his whole life and makes all of his movies in New Jersey. Some of them have been lost, but he's a really important part of early film history and especially part of Black cinema history. So that I thought was one of the coolest things I found this research. Okay. And now I have a story that is just so fun.
Okay.
And I have, so there's no reviews in this mini potion episode.
This potion this bottle.
Potion vial. But
potion number one, if you will.
Yes, I know. When we get to Valentine's Day, we have to do Love Potion number 9.
Obviously.
That will be the name of the episode.
Yeah.
Anyway, I do have some first-person narratives, though, even though I don't have reviews. So, there's an actress named Pearl White who starred in this series of, I'm not sure if they're films or if they're short. It was like a little series. It was called The Perils of Pauline. From 1914, is made by the company Pathé, P-A-T-H-E with the accent over the E. I'm sure they still exist. They're a big thing. And it was called a cliffhanger film. And one blog that I found actually suggested that The Perils of Pauline was the literal origin of the phrase cliffhanger, because Pearl White actually dangles from the Palisade Cliffs.
I was going to say, is there a legitimate cliffhanger? That's really, terrifying, but fun.
Yeah, I did try to, like, back this up with the Oxford English Dictionary. Mm-hmm. They actually claim that the earliest use of cliffhanger was 1931 from a serial based on Buffalo Bill. But they did say that the Oxford English Dictionary definition says originally with reference to radio and film serials, which ended with episodes with their protagonists literally hanging from cliffs or similarly dangerous situations. So
I can understand.
I just thought that was so fun.
Yeah, I can understand it being like commercialized or commercialized or made like more of a household term with Buffalo Bill, because those would have been like the cartoons, like the chapter plays that played before movies. And my brain is only heading in that direction because I may or may not have started to reread Misery this morning.
Can you see this photograph? Oh, wait a minute. Why am I doing... I could just show you the cover of the book. Oh, that's easier.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, do you want to describe the photograph for our viewers, Beth?
Actually, can you open it to the page? Because there's a bit of a glare on the book cover because the book is shiny.
Yeah. I know, this is like very much like a textbook book. This textbook book is all about how Fort Lee... with, like, the OG Hollywood.
That's the heartland. Okay. So... is that how they're shooting her hanging off a cliff?
I guess so.
There's a camera, and it's, like, pointing down, and there's a guy laying underneath it.
And another... who's very much on the edge of the cliff. Yeah, like, pointing downwards.
Very much on the edge of the cliff, and then I'm guessing that's Lillian Griffiths? Or, no, what's her name?
No. This is Pearl White.
Pearl White. I'm guessing that's Pearl White in like a fur coat or whatever in the foreground. And I'm assuming that's the director going like, so you're going to hang down right here, right?
I also love the guy who's holding onto his belt loop.
Oh, I couldn't see him. Which one is he? Is that the camera guy?
Not the camera guy. Like, there's the guy in the white shirt right behind Pearl.
Oh, I didn't even see him. Oh my god, yes. He's like, please don't fall. We put so much money into this.
Yeah.
There was no OSHA on that film set.
No. So that's the Palisades that gave us the cliffhanger. So I just thought this was so fun, but if you want to hear Pearl White's story of how she got involved with these cliffhangers, she has the cutest little write-up about her memory of getting involved with these films. So I would love to read from this story called Just Me, written in 1919 by Pearl White. All right, so
I'm ready.
She says, "The idea of serial pictures had just been born over in Jersey, and Pathé offered me the chance to risk my life through a series of episodes called The Perils of Pauline. So I dashed over to the studio intending to take the job. I was met by my old director, Mr. Louis Gosnier, who is still residing at the head of the firm, and he laid bare the situation. I don't mind telling you that I nearly walked out of the studio without signing the contract that they had prepared. To be sure, they offered me a lot of money and so much advertising that I couldn't escape gaining at least some fame. However, the odds seemed against me. 'Hello, girl. How do you like my Paris?' were the words that greeted me from my old boss." Gosnier was French.
Mm.
Pathé is French.
Yeah, it's like it's all coming together.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So he's calling New Jersey Paris, so we could have another episode about how New Jersey was once Paris.
I love it.
Anyway, Pearl says, "Wonderful," said I, "but what about the job you are tempting me with?" "Well, do you want to become famous?" he asked. "Certainly," I replied. "That's been my lifelong struggle." "Then sign here," he continued, handing me a couple of typewritten pages and casually asking if I carried any life insurance. Now, I had never signed a legal document before, but that speech about life insurance made me hesitate and read the pages before me. The further into the contract I got, the worse things looked for me, and when I got to the clause, quote, "The party of the second part, being of age, takes her part in this motion picture play at her own risk, and in case of accident or loss of life, she or relations have no claim for damages against the part of the first part," etc., etc., I was all for leaving this offer stand and getting back to New York as fast as the streetcar would take me. There were streetcars. Anyway. "What do you expect me to do? Lose my life?" I asked. "Accidents do sometimes happen," he volunteered. "Here, read a couple of manuscripts and judge for yourself." Then he handed me some manuscripts and walked out of the office. I read the first three episodes of this hairbreadth escape serial, and that was about enough for me. I shouted for help, and Mr. Gosnier entered from the next room. "Well, how do you like it?" he said. "Like it," I answered. "Here, take a look for yourself." And I began turning over the pages. You can see for yourself I'm not the person for that part. In the first place, I'm too clumsy. And in the second place, I have too much respect for my life. In these first three episodes, I had to play tennis, which I could not. I had to take a flight in an aeroplane, which I didn't like much because it was supposed to crash to the ground in a wreck. Then I had to drive a motor car through water, fire, and sand. This also didn't sound reasonable. Then I had to go out to sea in a yacht, which was all right, only that I was to jump overboard just as the boat was blown up by the villain, and I couldn't swim. Then I was to be a captive in a balloon, but the villain was to cut the rope, and I was to go sailing about for a while, then drop an anchor, which was to catch in a tree, and I was to descend some 250 feet on this, reaching a cliff on the side of a mountain. Then I was to be showered with rocks, and so on.
There is a poem by Shel Silverstein that I can't remember the name of. True Story.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like a full page long, and it's like, "This morning I jumped on my horse and went out for a ride. Some wild outlaws chased me and they shot me in my side. So I crawled into a wildcat's cave and da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da." And it just goes on and on and on and on about all these terrible things that are befalling this person throughout the day. And then at the end of the poem, he dies.
Oh my
God. That sounds a bit like Pauline.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It does sound a bit like that. So, Anyway, the state of New Jersey offered a lot of benefits to making movies. A lot of benefits that, you know, like Chicago didn't necessarily have. And that's that New Jersey had easy access to a lot of different types of locales for sets. It's near the coast. It's near the mountains. It's got farmland and countryside. Mm-hmm. It's got the city.
A landscape for every need.
A landscape for every need. So that brings me to some just like fun context. I want to give a little bit more details about Fort Lee and the surrounding areas. And I have to do a shout out to Professor Emeritus Richard Kozarski from Rutgers University. He is the guy who knows all this history. He wrote this book, Fort Lee, the film town, or he edited it. It's compiled from a lot of different writings. Mm-hmm. And he has another book called Hollywood on the Hudson about this era. Cute. So he...
It sounds like the name of a party.
Yes. And the intro to Fort Lee Film Town was also written by a historian named Paul C. Spare. And I have some other articles that were really useful too for this. But just... This is, like, totally not connected to anything, but it's kind of a fun fact. The Kelly Color Laboratory tried to make films in color as early as the 1920s, and they were based in Fort Lee, New Jersey.
Oh, wow.
They did not figure out how to make films in color, but it's still cool.
They were trying to, like, film it in color, or they, like, would colorize after?
I don't actually know. I would have to... We'd have to have another episode about
I would love to have an episode attempts. About, like, colorization and Technicolor. That could be really fun.
It would be cool, too, because I do know the earliest films, they would literally go in afterwards and color the film strips.
Yes.
Yeah. So the other thing, too, that I learned from this book is that Fort Lee... even when people kind of went out west to Hollywood, Fort Lee still played an important role. Spare writes that the New York-based home offices, quote, frequently mistrusted production folks on the other coast, and negatives were often shipped east as soon as films were ready for release. So over the years, Fort Lee became a major depository for several studios, among them Warner's and RK. Oh, so, and then he also says that the largest of the storage companies, Bonnet Film Storage, operated facilities in Fort Lee well into the 1970s. Oh, and also, this is, again, another totally random thing, but I found a Louisiana connection for you,
yeah.
Bill.
Yeah.
All right. So, Spare says, quote, that if Fort Lee ever erects a statue to someone who personified their film experience, Jules Brulateur would be an interesting candidate. He had a unique role in bringing the film industry to Fort Lee. As new companies began organizing, Brulateur was available to advise them. After all, new companies were his new customers. He helped Eclair build their studio in Fort Lee. He was involved in the organization of Universal, as in, like, Universal Studios, mm-hmm. and he facilitated the opening of the Peerless Studio. A Creole from Louisiana, Brulateur spoke French and Spanish, which doubtless helped him establish a special relationship with the sizable community of French filmmakers who worked in Fort Lee, like Pate. Mm-hmm. He was especially close to the legendary director Maurice Tourneur. Although Brulateur had offices in New York and a branch in Los Angeles, he maintained the facility in Fort Lee until his death in 1946. He was a film stock provider, and he was actually the largest film stock provider up until World War II.
Interesting.
Yeah. So there you go. We have a little Louisiana-New Jersey crossover.
There you go. Yeah, there's a lot of filming that happens in Louisiana these days for similar kind of benefits, as far as I understand.
That could be another potion episode. Okay.
Okay.
We're now getting to our story's main character. He is both hero and villain.
Ooh.
And his name is Thomas Alva Edison.
Bum, bum. I feel like that needs that Law and Order gong.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, I will say, Thomas Edison did not actually invent the movies, and he also did not invent the Edison Vitascope, an early film projector, even though it has his name.
Yeah.
And for all the crossword puzzle lovers out there, his middle name is Alva, which is frequently an answer to a New York Times crossword puzzle clue. So, Edison was nicknamed the Wizard of Menlo Park, which is town in New Jersey. He was in that West Orange, Menlo Park area, all very close to Fort Lee. He was the inventor of the phonograph.
Yep.
And, you know, the Edison light bulb that was so trendy with millennial designers. Do you have an Edison light bulb, Belle, that you're looking at? I'm not looking at my Edison light bulb nightlight either.
Right, I do not have one that I'm not looking at, a single one, but rather a strip of many. Anyway, next.
Anyway, so Edison's interest in making movies actually is because of his invention, the phonograph. He wanted to create moving pictures to pair with his sound machine. So I think that that's actually kind of really cool that, you know, we think of this silent era as being the beginning of films, but the person who was really trying to get into this very early on actually wanted to make movies backwards. With sound. Yeah. Yeah, but didn't quite make that. I mean, he would play like music separately with his music with his movies, but it's not, they weren't talkies. Mm-hmm. So he invents, or his assistant invents, he had a whole company, he had a lot of people working for him, this thing called the kinetoscope. Mm-hmm. And this made me giggle, but I looked this up in the Oxford English Dictionary and this is the correct terminology. The kinetoscope was a peep show.
Yes.
Which, at this time, did not have erotic connotations.
You can't Bell's see holding this as you're listening, but I'm doing the, like, you know the little red camera, like, yeah, thing that had the little lever that you would chick when you were a kid? What is that,
yeah,
called? Not a viewfinder?
Don't remember.
But that toy, yeah, that's what Peep Show meant, essentially that.
Yeah, you were looking into a little contraption and looking at pictures, basically moving so fast they looked like they were in motion. So that's what Edison's company came up with as, and so that's not
Viewmaster. I knew it had view in the
Viewmaster. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And a peep show is also an erotic thing, but this is true. Yeah, that thing. The tricky thing is, the kinetoscope gets patented in 1891, and it's available to audiences in major American cities starting in 1894. The tricky thing about the kinetoscope is that, like, there were lots of people around this time who were trying to figure out how to make motion, like, literal motion. I'm going to use the phrase motion pictures as opposed to movies, because that's really
different. Yeah.
That's kind of a key phrase here in this very, very, like, sort of primitive moment of movie development, is the motion picture. So the kinetoscope is one of these really early creations, and I just love this story, but one of the first movies made for the kinetoscope was called Fred Ott's Sneeze. You can watch it on the Library of Congress's website.
Of course you can. Oh my god. Shut up.
In it, a very goofy man with a big mustache named Fred Ott sneezes.
Mm-hmm. I gathered.
And that's it.
And that's it. That's the tweet.
That's the whole movie. Mm-hmm. I think it was like 45, 46 frames to make.
I thought you were going to say 45 or 46 seconds, and I was like, that's a long sneeze.
No. It's just the duration of a normal length sneeze. Also, sneezing is really anticlimactic without the sound.
Yes.
So this movie was made in 1894. It was kind of made more for, like, advertising purposes, to be like, and it's supposed to be funny. Fred Ott did, like, goofy things in front of the camera to make people laugh. The bar was pretty low at this point in time. And, you know, I also really love this story because since, like, 1894, clearly this is one of the earliest motion pictures ever made. It reminds me of the ancient Egyptians who believed that the universe began with a sneeze.
Oh my god, I love that. I didn't know that creation, so that's amazing.
Exactly. There's some speculation about whether or not the, like, Egyptians meant a... Well, whether or not they meant a sneeze or ejaculation, but whatever.
Oh my god.
Same difference. Anyway, Edison very quickly realized that he was going to need more material than Fred Ott sneezing if he was going to entertain people. So he got into film production itself, not just the creation of the technology, mm-hmm, but actually telling the stories. So he creates this thing. Oh, I have pictures. Can I share my screen with you? He creates this thing called the Black Maria.
Ooh.
He builds it for about $600, and it's kind of like the first movie studio.
Okay. Yeah, you can share.
Now, I'm going to try to share my screen.
It sounds like a black box, like a black box theater or something.
Yeah. Well, I'm going to show you a picture of it. So this is a sketch of the Black Maria.
Okay.
And I like this sketch because you can see here that the roof mm-hmm. props up. Yeah. And that's to let the sunlight in.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And then I have an actual photograph of it. Okay. So this is what it looked like. And I think what we're looking at here is you can see that the roof is actually up on it. Yeah. It's also kind of floating above the ground.
Yeah, it's like up on a foundation.
Yeah.
I guess so they could move it around.
Yeah. So there's one historian had a really funny description of this. So it could be moved.
Hence it floating on the ground.
Which is why it's like floating mm-hmm. on the ground. Did I mention it was made for $600? A little more than $600?
What a great budget for a movie studio.
Yeah. And it had a glass top. So the idea was that they could move it to follow the light of the sun.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
It was about 25 by 20 feet. And our friend Paul Spare, I feel really bad if I'm saying his name wrong. But anyway, he describes it as, quote, looking for all the world like an ungainly, misshapen tar paper shack.
Yeah, that's not an inaccurate description, unfortunately.
Yeah, so that was where Edison's company was making their movies. In New Jersey.
New Jersey.
Back in the 1890s and into the early 1900s. And so, all right. So we have the kinetoscope, which is like this peep show. But what about the way we think about watching movies now in a theater? Mm-hmm. What about projection?
What about projection, Laura? Tell me.
What about projection?
Do you want me to tee you up for that? Laura, how did we get from moving pictures to projections?
That's a great question, Belle, and I'm so glad you asked it, because Edison actually didn't want to get into projection.
Okay.
He thought it would undercut his kinetoscope business, because he was like, then everybody can just gather and watch these movies, and we can't sell so many contraptions. Which was kind of like maybe a mistake financially.
No.
Yeah. Yeah. So this other guy ends up creating the projector. And guess what? I can't remember what his name is. It's called the Vitascope. And I can't remember his name because the full name is the Edison Vitascope. Because when he invented it, Edison convinced him to put his name on it. Because he was like, it'll be better for publicity if we just pretend it was mine. And then he was like, don't worry. Once it's established, we'll put your name on it.
And they never did.
Yeah. I don't remember this guy's name.
What a bag of dicks.
Yeah. So, that's gonna get worse. And also, while we're on the topic of projection, one of the articles I found says that people actually commonly projected ads onto the sides of buildings as early as 1896. Oh. And I was like, oh my god, so moving ads is not actually such a novel concept.
Oh.
It's kind of one of the themes in this episode. It's things that, like, we think of as, oh, nobody knew how to do that then, or nobody was imagining that then. And it's like, no, people were imagining things then.
It just wasn't
always executed.
Yeah, it's not in the context that it would really work successfully in. That's wild.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So, we need to talk about patents and lawsuits. So, Edison was famous for inventing the phonograph,
uh-huh.
the light bulb, mm-hmm. and could probably be equally famous for his extremely litigious personality.
Is this one of those, like, patent bullshit things? Like, he came up with the idea, or somebody came up with the idea, and then he did the patent for it before they could?
Well,
never mind. I'll let you
tell the
story.
It's really complicated, and I'm going to try to take you through this the best way I can as somebody who is not a copyright lawyer. So, fun fact. There was another film production dude named Sigmund Lubin, and apparently conservationists, I believe he was from Germany,
well, yes.
conservationists found were able to, like, find a lot of his work preserved. And Lupin was one of the companies that was based in Philadelphia. Conservationists were actually able to preserve a lot of his work because Edison had it preserved in his archives because of his plans to sue Lupin.
That checks out.
So
yeah.
This portion of the story largely comes from an article published in 2007 in Film History called Copyright Dupes, Piracy, and New Media in Edison v. Lubin, 1903. And this was written by Peter DeCherney. And I'm just going to take us through this article, actually, because it explains a lot of this early film history and how we wound up in Hollywood.
Can we just... Yes. How fucking petty can you get? Like, at this point,
that's not the pettiest we're gonna get.
But, like, at this point, quite possibly the only reason we know of this guy's existence or involvement is because Edison had to be a petty bitch. Oh my god. Yeah. Okay. I'm ready.
So, I also really appreciate this article because it starts with a quote from a film historian writing in the 1920s. His name was Terry Ramsey. Mm-hmm. And he called the first decades of the film industry in the U.S. a lawless frontier. So I do feel like you could kind of associate the Western with this moment in film history.
Oh, yeah.
In more ways than one.
Okay.
Yeah. So here's kind of the foundational information you need to know for understanding the history that this article goes through. And that's that at this time, people were copywriting motion pictures as photographs.
Because okay. Because there wasn't any copyright law.
We might already need a lawyer.
No, I can understand that, because there wasn't an existing law for something like a motion picture, and so they were working with what they had. Okay, yeah.
Yeah, and if you think about it, like I said, I like using the term motion picture in this talk because a lot of what we're talking about are basically...
It's like a stop motion situation.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So, and this is kind of the thesis of the article, so I'm actually just going to read this to you because I think this gets to the crux of the issue here. So, DeCherney wrote... Quote, and the story of copyright law's impact on the development of the U.S. film industry begins with Edison's successful, though short-lived, attempt to monopolize the film industry. The Edison Manufacturing Company and later Edison's Trust, the Motion Picture Patents Company, were involved in every landmark copyright case leading up to the 1912 Townsend Amendment, which officially added motion pictures to the Copyright Act.
Oh my god.
So that's like a lot. Lot of lawsuits.
He pissed so many people off. They were like, let's just make a law and get this motherfucker off our backs.
Yeah. So, all right. So you have to understand that they were trying to copyright motion pictures as photographs. Obviously, this gets murky. A lot of these lawsuits are about, can you actually consider a motion picture a photograph? Mm-hmm. Is it actually protected material or not? Mm-hmm. So that brings us to the other foundational concept you have to understand, which was the practice of duping. So basically making copies of other people's films and piracy. The, like, you wouldn't steal a car ad. That's what we're at.
Oh my god! I never thought those things would be relevant beyond my teenage years, but here we are again. Okay.
Here we are.
Like, piracy, like, they wouldn't just make the same movie themselves. They would actually copy the motion picture.
No, they were copying the picture. Okay.
So it was
That's like my understanding. Bootlegs. That they were copying. Yeah.
Okay.
That is my understanding. So some companies had standards when it came to stealing other people's movies, like Edison's Manufacturing Company or the other film's film company Biograph. That's going to become a really big one in this story. They did not dupe films that were actually registered as photographs under the copyright law. So if you copyrighted your movie, they didn't dupe it. But if you did not bother to copyright your movie, which again, some people were like, does it even count because it's not really a photograph? Then they felt that was fair game for them to steal your movie.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And they also basically had what I would kind of call duping mercenaries. So...
Trolls.
Yeah, like, so the Vitagraph company, the Lubin and Ahmet companies, like, basically would, like, do the duping for them so they could kind of be like, we didn't actually do it, but somebody else did it.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
Yeah. And they also use subterfuge to dupe movies because...
Good word. Can we just...
I know, I was really glad I got to throw that in here.
Subterfuge.
So, do you know who Georges Méliès is?
The name sounds familiar.
Okay, have you ever seen the image of kind of a cartoony moon with a face and it's got
a rocket launched inside? Yeah. Okay.
So that is from one of the earliest movies ever made. It was made by the French filmmaker Georges Méliès. And so a lot of the duping that was going on in the United States was trying to keep up with what was coming out of European film. Mm-hmm. And Georges Méliès was one of those big dudes. And Méliès realized Edison was duping his movies. And so Edison actually had to use multiple, like, tiers of subterfuge to try to, and, like, go-betweens to try to get hold of the Méliès. Because basically, like, if Edison walked into a, like, tried to, like, get his hands on Méliès, like, Méliès would have, was, like, not, Méliès probably had, like, a whole wall of, you know, don't give movies to these people.
Little Polaroids.
With Edison at the top.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So, Edison... So, the film industry at this time ends up shocked because Edison gets involved in a patent lawsuit against this rival company, Biograph, that I mentioned before. And Edison wins. And people didn't expect Edison to win because the person who was making Biograph's tech was W.K.L. Dixon, who used to be Edison's kind of like right-hand man and helped him develop the kinetoscope. So everybody thought, well, surely Dixon knows how to avoid...
Mm-hmm.
Edison's lawsuits, right, because he knew the company inside out. And so they were really shocked when Edison actually won his lawsuit against
his former
Biograph. Yeah. This decision does end up getting overturned, though, in Biograph's favor.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. There's a lot of... This is like... Just keeps going back and forth.
Everybody's petty as hell really seems to be the moral of the story.
Yeah, that's the moral of the story. So when that Biograph decision is overturned, Edison ends up switching. So that had to do with the camera. Like, that was like a technology lawsuit. And so that's the point where he stops trying to go after, like, the patents and the technology and after the copyright infringement. So the legal battle shifts here from, like, what we're using to make the movie to the actual motion picture itself. And he goes after Biograph, Selig Company, and Lubin. And those companies are based in New York, Chicago, and Philadelphia. So he's trying to take down these other nascent film centers in the country. And he starts, like, running advertisements that, like, dupers will be prosecuted. Even though, like, he was also duping.
Well, yes. Well, Laura, we don't have to talk about that part of it. But if you do it, that's terrible. Also, just in the context of that serious headline, dupers is just hilarious.
Yeah. And also, Edison actually gets the cameraman for the Lubin company to come work for him, and he like pays him off super well.
Poaching.
And he basically did that so this guy's name was J. Blair Smith. He does that so Smith can testify that, quote, Lubin had been using equipment protected by Edison's patents. And so Lubin actually ends up fleeing to Berlin.
Oh my god, it's that serious?
Yeah, he doesn't come back until, like, the case is overturned.
Jesus.
Yeah. And in one of these cases, Lubin also claims that the copyright seal had been removed from an Edison film he duped, so therefore he could possibly know that he shouldn't be copying this. And...
I didn't see the sticker. What are you talking about?
Yeah, and then somebody who used to work for him wrote a memoir later on saying that his job with Lubin was to cut off the copyright notices.
So he could have plausible deniability. So that
they could claim they didn't know.
Oh my god.
Yeah. This is the argument that Edison's lawyer uses at one point. That is basically the idea that film doesn't matter without projection, which I also think is funny because, as I'll remind you, the projector was actually invented by this other guy that Edison convinced to put his name on it. Yeah. So the lawyers, this is the lawyer's argument, quote, Edison's genius, quote, in other words, oh, actually, this might just be the historian's quote. But anyway, he said Edison's genius, in other words, lay behind every film, regardless of who shot it. And as a result, Edison alone owned the exclusive right to create moving images.
Jesus.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, my God. I mean, that's what he wanted in the beginning, it seems.
Yeah, yes.
And then yeah. Other people figure it out.
Yeah. So we have, like, another... Edison starts registering movies as dramas as well as photographs. So I think at this time, okay. A drama kind of means... typically means more like a theatrical piece.
Was this... this was in, before they added motion picture in that...
Yeah, we're still before...
What's the act mm-hmm. called again?
Townsend Amendment.
Okay. Townsend. Yeah. Okay, got you. All right.
Mm-hmm. Or Townsend Act. Yeah.
So he was trying to find, like, a workaround.
Yeah. So there's a case in 1905 that says that films could be considered as dramas. Mm-hmm. And I pictures. Believe. No, dramas. We're not even at them as motion pictures.
Films could be considered as dramas. Motion pictures could be considered as dramas.
Oh, well, the historian uses the word films, mm-hmm. but yeah.
Gotcha.
And I think it's not until, like, 1911 that we actually start going, oh, maybe we need to actually have a new copyright law here. So, anyway. All right. So, Edison and Lubin have, like, this big case. Lubin wins. Mm-hmm. And basically, when Lubin wins, it means that films cannot be copyrighted as photographs. And the takeaway from this is that everybody's like, great, duping's legal because there's no protection.
Right, because you can't copyright it.
I don't know if that's really, like, what should be the takeaway, but that's
what happens.
What people took away. Mm-hmm. So then, wait, but it's not over because then Edison appeals the case with Lubin and he wins. But his company was also duping.
Right.
Anyway.
Yeah. But, like, now.
Oh, and then, wait, our friend George Melies. His brother comes over to the United States to try to protect Méliès's films. Mm-hmm. He pretends to be a buyer at Lubin's company, and Lubin actually shows him one of his plagiarized films that he gave. Oh, it's the Trip to the Moon movie, except he renamed it A Trip to Mars.
Oh my God, they arranged a sting. That's ridiculous. For motion pictures.
And I know there should be a movie about the early days
there
of the movie.
There should.
Once again, if anybody, Belle and I have a screenplay for you. If anybody would like to hire us as screenwriters. Mm-hmm. All right. So when Melies's brother comes over to try to, like, find out what's going on with his brother's films and if they're being stolen in the U.S., Edison gets freaked out that Melies's brother is actually there so that Melies can pirate Edison's movies.
Oh my God.
So he writes him a strong letter.
Girl, this is so not about you right now. Back off.
Yeah. He's like, I sued Biograph, Selig, and Lubin, and I won. So you might want to watch out if you think you're going to steal my movies. And he also does not mention that he lost the first round of the Lubin case.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. He won in the end. That's all that matters.
Yeah.
I love that they, like, this, in the grand scheme of, like, crimes plaguing humanity, this is so insignificant, but so dramatic and so petty.
Yeah, are you ready for it to get pettier? So Edison makes this movie called Jack and the Beanstalk.
He made it? He didn't steal it from anybody?
No, he actually...
Okay.
Wait for it, Belle. Oh, he did actually make this movie. And... Or his company made this movie. And they decide that it's not financially worth the risk of releasing it. And then eventually they decide to release it anyway. It gets immediately duped by Lubin. And Lubin... tries to say it was actually his original work and that Edison is actually the duper of the movie. And this is all just to get revenge on Edison winning the appeals case. Yeah. So that appeal that Edison won, the result of that is that film is basically, it basically goes back to film is photography. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay.
So we're back to that argument. We still haven't figured out that we need a whole new copyright law here. And then Lubin basically gets the Edison Manufacturing Company to agree that they will not advertise this court. Like, remember how I said they were putting out advertisements being like, dupers will be prosecuted. Yeah, yeah. So Lubin makes Edison agree that he's not going to, like, do ads like that. I think that they find some weird way to work around
it. Of course they do. Of course they do.
I think the greatest line in this entire article is, quote, Lubin just went on duping, end quote.
This word is too silly for this conversation.
I know.
Oh my god. All right, so Lubin just went on duping.
Yeah. So as, like, so during this time, we're really evolving rapidly beyond Fred Ott sneezing on
camera. Oh god, I had forgotten about him already. Poor guy. Poor Fred.
Yeah. And as narratives, poor Fred's still sneezing in the background. Somebody give him a tissue. So as films are becoming more complicated, and, you know, at this point we're looking at the early 1900s, the photography thing is getting to be harder and harder to argue. Mm-hmm. So Edison wins this Lubin case, and... and I love this point that the historian made as well. He basically says that, quote, the Edison Company was now in the business of fighting lawsuits as much as manufacturing technology and entertainment.
I mean, really?
And started at, and so after winning the Lubin case, it actually starts its own in-house legal division. Yeah.
Do you think at any point somebody in this company was like, hey, so Tom, can I call you Tom? Mr. Edison. We could just not. How do you think that conversation went?
Well, all right, so this is how it evolves. Remember how in the beginning I said Edison's Manufacturing Company and eventually the Motion Picture Patents Company? Mm-hmm. So the Motion Picture Patents... this historian describes it as a cartel. The Motion Picture Patents Company...
that checks
basically
out.
Basically... Yeah, basically, Edison gets a bunch of these competitive production companies to all join together as part of this Motion Picture Patents Company. And it's really his way of trying to control the entire film industry.
You did say at the beginning of this he was just trying to monopolize, and...
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So, on the topic of the Motion Picture Patents Company... What are some studios that were actually hanging out in, like, the Fort Lee area at this time?
Tell me about them.
Okay. Well, the most recognizable names are Universal and Fox. Ever heard of those guys?
Oh, my God. Yeah, all
they right. started in New Jersey. Yep.
Okay.
So, basically, in answer to this Motion Picture Patents Company, another, what, like, so we're going back to the Fort Lee Filmtown book. But another by our friend Richard Kozarski. And so this other, what he calls an umbrella organization, starts to kind of be able to compete with the Motion Picture Patents Company. And basically this umbrella organization is becoming home to all of these independent filmmakers. And by independent, I mean they're not part of Edison's cartel, as the other historian called it. And they call this group the Universal Film Manufacturing Company. Hmm. So this is the beginning of the Universal Studios. Is that what they're called now?
Universal Studios, yeah.
Yeah. And the guy who is basically in charge of this company, I mean, it's a little complicated at first, but the guy who basically ends up in charge of this, his name is Carl, I believe it's pronounced Lamel or Lamely, which... those of our listeners out in LA probably are very familiar with this name because it's a really big independent movie theater out in LA.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. And he would basically be in charge of this company until 1936.
Wow.
So what about Fox? Mm-hmm. So William Fox actually started out as somebody who rented films and showcased films.
I don't know why, but it never occurred to me it was called Fox because it was like named after a person. Is that weird?
Yeah.
Okay. William Fox.
No, it never occurred to me either. Yeah. I didn't think about that. I just always think of the Doors song, 20th Century Fox.
I don't know what I think of.
That's about a sexy lady. Not a movie studio.
Okay, so William Fox.
Yeah, so William Fox starts Fox. So he started out as basically, like, you know, kind of like a theater owner. He was renting movies and showing them. And this is interesting. So he's able to, he basically becomes a film distributor with funds by this guy named John F. Dryden, who is the president of Newark's Prudential Insurance Company, which I also thought was interesting because for those of you like me who have spent a lot of time riding NJ Transit, you're probably very familiar with the Prudential Center in Newark where, you know, really big superstars play really big expensive concerts.
Oh, righty.
So I'm guessing it came from this Prudential Insurance Company. Mm-hmm. And I have this great, weird little story that's from an article written in 1917 by a man named Robert C. Duncan. And his article was called, yes, The Fox Studios, 1,000 People Working in 4 Studios at Fort Lee, New Jersey, indicates the scope of this company's organization, and the West is still to be heard from. Which,
burn!
I think we did get lost.
You at, the West?
Yeah, so he's got this great little story about trying to write an article about Fox Studios and how big they are. And I loved his little details, so I'm gonna read this to you.
Okay, I'm ready.
So Duncan writes, arriving at Fort Lee, New Jersey, I inquired how to reach the Fox Company. I was rudely surprised to get conflicting answers. The streetcar, oh my God, I love it when they mention streetcars. The streetcar conductor was sure that if I got off at a certain street and turned to my right, I would collide with it, the Fox Company, head-on fashion. An Italian vendor of groceries directed me to bear to my left down such and such a road and then turn into a path through the woods, and I would come to it in 5 minutes. Other persons...
Yeah. That doesn't sound directions. That sounds like a riddle from, like, a troll under a bridge. Another person.
Other persons whom I asked had their own and very certain idea about where the company was located. The upshot was that all of them were right. The puzzle was solved when I discovered that there was not one, but 4 studios flying the Fox banner. So as you can see, film studios at this time were rather prolific in North Jersey. Yeah. And
through the woods.
Through the woods. So, all right, how did we end up going west to Hollywood? So there's historians argue with each other about this a little bit. There are some who say it's this and some who say it's that, but there's one article that first of all, did you know the Saturday Evening Post still exists?
Yeah.
Oh, really? I thought it went out of business like 50 years ago.
Oh, I mean, I don't think, it's not like I read it every week or anything, but I feel like that's a newspaper name I've heard in recent, like, months or something.
Oh, okay. Anyway, I just thought once there was no more Norman Rockwell, there was no more Saturday Evening Post. So, all right. Garrett O'Brien, writing for the Saturday Evening Post in 2021, writes this article called Thomas Edison, the Unintentional Founder of Hollywood. Mm-hmm. And the way O'Brien describes it is he says, quote, Thomas Edison's stranglehold on the East Coast movie industry led to independent filmmakers wanting to get far away from him and his monopoly. Naturally, Hollywood seemed like the ideal destination. Now,
that makes sense.
Yeah, in the Fort Lee Film Town book, our friend Paul Spare kind of argues with this. Yeah, friend of the show. he says that Edison definitely didn't help.
Oh, sure, yeah.
But that there's other reasons. Some of the typical reasons, and O'Brien does cite this, that people went out to Los Angeles was, you know, generally nice weather. There was cheap land.
A lot of it at that time.
Yeah, exactly.
So, same other reasons people would go to the frontier.
Exactly. But people also went to the frontier to evade the law.
Oh, yeah. Right.
Yeah. And so our nemesis, the Motion Picture Patents Company, comes back again. But basically, once, like, Edison forced this, so here are some of, O'Brien actually kind of goes into the specifics of who's part of this Motion Picture Patents Company. So Biograph, which his old assistant Dixon was involved with, ends up becoming part of this. So he absorbs one of his nemesis. Is that right?
Yes.
Nemesis?
Yes. Okay. Nemesis is nemesis. Yes, that is correct.
Yes. And Biograph had a camera patent, so that basically meant they were now part of this coalition. Eastman Kodak, which made the film, becomes part of this company. So he controls the actual literal film stock itself. And basically, this guy also calls it a cartel. Basically, O'Brien says, quote, given how many patents the cartel covered, it was virtually impossible for any independent movie studio to make a film without being bombarded by copyright infringement lawsuits from the Motion Picture Patents Company. 289 legal complaints were directed at Universal Studios alone. Any movie being made at the time had to go through Edison, making him the king of the movie industry, end quote. And so O'Brien explains that basically the West was so far away at this time that judges just, like, didn't care as much. So even if stuff wound up in the court, like, they weren't necessarily going to, like, go after that. And most people found it too expensive to deal with, like, cross-country enforcement. So, and also just like a fun fact, they would even sometimes use like mobsters to intimidate people at this time. Like, it got real dramatic.
There we go. Okay, I was sitting here wondering, and I was just thinking, because the fact that you said O'Brien also calls it a cartel, and I was just thinking, like, there seems to be a very fine line between cartel and monopoly. And I was like, in the same way, it feels like there's a very, not feels like, but there is a very fine line between something like pyramid scheme and multi-level marketing, you know? And I was like, and I was like, I know, just because I've, for reasons unbeknownst to me, this is just where my brain is these days. I have watched a lot of documentaries and read a lot of autobiographies about people who were in MLMs. I know, that difference, and I'm like, so I wonder what is the difference that makes the fine line between cartel and monopoly. And then you said they use mobsters to enforce, and I'm like, that's it, that's the line, there it is.
All right, so one last legal case for you, and this brings us to the conclusion of our story. In 1915,
thrilling conclusion,
yes, we have a case called United States v. Motion Picture Patents Company.
The whole United States versus...
The whole United States basically versus Thomas Edison.
Oh my god.
And they used the Sherman Antitrust Act to take down Edison's monopoly. And so the conclusion of this case is, quote, a patentee may simply enforce his right to exclude infringement, but he must not use his patent as a weapon to disable a rival contestant or to drive him from the field, for he cannot justify such use. So basically, Hollywood was officially liberated from Edison's lawsuits and his mobsters.
And his mobsters.
And that is the end of Hollywood in New Jersey.
What a thrilling and petty as hell chapter of the life of Thomas Edison that I never knew until I met you and you told me this for the first time. Like, who'd have known?
Yeah. Who'd have known?
How at all do you think the film industry, like in Hollywood or whatever, how if at all do you think it might have been different if Edison had been one petty bitch and things had really blossomed in Fort Lee? What do you imagine that film industry looking like today?
You know, I wonder if that really would have. Well, I mean, first of all, I think that there's probably a lot of, I mean, there's a mix of very, very wealthy and very, very poor communities in that northern New Jersey area. And I wonder if that would have brought a little bit more economic revitalization to some of those cities. Of course, those cities have economic problems for a lot of reasons, including issues of racism that have nothing to do with the movie business. And I'm sure I
could have been made worse by an early booming film
industry. Yeah, Los Angeles also has very rich people and very, very poor people. Yeah. So that, yeah, I mean, this might just, you know, be a problem of American capitalism.
Hey,
that wouldn't have been helped by the movie business. I will say, though, I think, I mean, at this point, like, there is still a lot of movie industry in New York and its surrounding areas. And I wonder, honestly, if a similar outcome would have happened anyway. There's more space and land. And I'm sure back then it was cheaper to go west. And I wonder if you kind of would have wound up in a similar place with, like, a lot of movies being made out west and a lot of the business portion of studios being in New York.
Interesting.
Which I don't think is actually, you know,
a that far away from where it is.
How
now.
It's kind of is. So, yeah.
Fascinating.
I will say, though, I do think it's really interesting that, like, you know, at this point in time, Universal and Fox are considered the independent filmmakers. And I do think it's interesting to think about it. Like, it's kind of ironic because, well, because they were independent of the cartel.
Oh.
They were working on their own. Okay. And so the original founders of Hollywood would have been considered independent filmmakers. And in this really early day and age of Hollywood filmmaking, too, there was actually, like, it was not as controlled as it becomes later on, but that would be a whole other potion episode. So I do think it's really interesting that basically because of this, like, the independent filmmakers end up going to found the capital of the movie business in a very non-independent way. And that I would actually say that New York is kind of now more associated with an independent and avant-garde
film. Yeah, I would
agree. As a result. So I feel like there's kind of an ironic flip.
Like
that
the flip in
here.
The party system, but in the movie industry.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Wild.
So what do you think about all of this, Belle?
I just am bewildered by the fact that this is, like, you learn the big things about Thomas Edison in school, you know, the light bulb, the phonograph, that sort of stuff, but, like, not that you learn, I mean, you don't learn a lot about the film industry in school either, but, like, I don't know, this is just such a fascinating part of history that I am glad to know now, but I am sad that I didn't learn it until I was, like, well into my 20s. And, and I met you, and you told me that story for the first time, because, like, what a wild thing. And, like, you're right. There should be a movie about this. There's so many movies about the making
of
movies.
And Belle and I are happy to write it for you.
Right. But, like, I keep thinking this whole time of, like, I'll say, like, movies about the movie industry. Like, I will say this here now. I have never seen La La Land, and I really have no interest in seeing it.
I have seen La La Land, and controversial opinion, I think it could have actually been a good movie if the last 15 minutes didn't exist.
And I've heard that from a number of people, but I do
so maybe not a controversial opinion.
I do like movies about movies, and, like, when you brought up the one about the trip to the moon, I've just been thinking of Hugo this whole time, and, like, that's sort of just, like, magic of, like, the movies are such a cool and exciting place, and they have such a weird way of getting us there, and, like, in that movie they talk about having to, like, take out the negatives and, like, hand color them in so that you can see. And so just, like, what a weird part of movie history that I would be fascinated to see told as a story.
Yeah, it'd be really fun. And I also, back to our little accidental theme of things that seem very new now, but people were actually at least trying to make happen back then, I guess we've been a litigious society for a long time.
Oh, there you go. I didn't even think of it that way. Jesus.
Yeah. Ugh. All right. Well, do you have a tarot card for Thomas Alva Edison that you know all about him?
Oh, let me think a minute. Oof. Actually, yes. I just pulled this.
Oh, okay.
I just pulled this for an unrelated reason for a different thing. But I was kind of looking more into it, doing a deeper dive, you know, like, online into, other interpretations of this card. The Seven of Wands actually, has a specific meaning of, like, people turning on each other, like, specifically in creative endeavors. And so this, yeah, this feels very much like you're just turning on the people you're supposed to work with, the people who are supposed to be your partners, like his old, like, partners and assistants, and the people who actually created his technology, you know, turning against the people who are in, like, who just have the same goal as, or theoretically have the same goal as you. Like, his goal was, like, clearly from the beginning wanting to monopolize things, but, you know, and I won't say that everybody else in this situation was virtuous, exactly, but, you know, they all have the same goal of, this is a cool new technology, and we want to make these things to entertain people, and then they're just turning around and ripping each other's throats out for trying to do the thing that they're all trying to do, and that's very Seven of Wands energy, so I would give him that.
That's actually really perfect, mm-hmm. because I have some concluding thoughts on this story, okay. and that actually dovetails perfectly with what my takeaway from the story is. So, shall I wrap it up?
Let's do it.
All right. So, you know, I think there's a way to look at all the backstabbing and manipulation and thievery that is part of this story, and to definitely see, like, the worst aspects of American history in it. But I found myself thinking that given the current political climate in which the idea of American greatness and patriotism are being co-opted by completely anti-American would-be authoritarians and fascists hell-bent on destroying democracy, that I think it's important to point out that this story is also one in which really brilliant people fed off of each other, and yes, they did not always do it in the most ethical fashion, but bear with me here. They fed off each other in order to build upon each other's dreams and accomplishments, to evolve technology, and to open a path towards a new art form that continues to make strides in technological advancement and to be used in creatively innovative ways to this day. And that plays a really important role in all of our lives and can also play an important role in fighting the fascists by being about, you know, being open-minded. And all of this started with Fred Ott's sneeze. So
Bless you, Fred Ott.
America. No, bless you, America.
Bless you, America. Here's a Kleenex.
Yep.
All right.
Good night.
You can find your Silver Nitrate Witches on various online platforms at LJ Valenza and at Bellang303. Thanks so much to Fine Motor for the use of their song Highway Moon. You can check out more about the band at finemotormusic.com. Thanks for listening. Stay witchy and keep watching movies.